This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit. It's true. It's true.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Ooh, do you feel that chill, Nick?
No, I don't feel any kind of a chill, because it's fucking 100 degrees still in September here, and it's miserable, Greg. It's the worst thing.
It is 100 plus degrees in Georgia and Alabama, Nick. But do you know where it's not 100 degrees, I'm assuming?
Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada,
where we've returned to our normal... Our normal recording studios right here in Ho-Ho Loon Plaza inside serene Vancouver, British Columbia in the, I don't know what else we have to mention that we're part of, but by God, it's a gigantic facility, that's for sure. The L-shaped studio, of course. I'm Greg Phillips. He is Nick Duke. We are the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and we are back with business as usual this week. Starting a brand new theme-free month.
Hadn't had one of these in a while.
Here at the HTF. And what we're going to do this week, because Nick's had a very busy, busy weekend, is we are going to jump into the easiest of our shows to prepare for, Countdown. That's right, folks. This is Countdown, where we count down things, if you can imagine that. And...
Greg, Sonic has fried Oreos. I just discovered this.
Oh?
Yes. I just saw an advertisement on the television screen where those two annoying guys
eating fried Oreos. Those two guys, or one of them's always like, hey, do you ever wonder why? And then he asks a question that has nothing to do with the food product. And the other guy's like, how does that relate to the food product? And the guy's like, well, it's just like the food product. Mm. And then they eat it.
Well, in this case, the food product is a fried Oreo, and now I'm intrigued.
We're fat!
Yes. Yes, we are.
But we are not counting down our favorite fat characters in comics, although that's a pretty good idea
for the
future. We should earmark that one. We were just talking the other day about needing more countdown ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and needing more fat characters in comics.
Oh, of course, but you always need those, and on television, and on movies as well. What we need, though, is a countdown list that's appropriate for September. We're not doing a theme month, but we do try to be timely. And in this case, a DC animated movie just dropped a few weeks ago on the DC Universe app. It's also available digitally. It's also available on DVD and Blu-ray, etc., etc. And it is an adaptation of one of my favorite comic book stories of all time, a book that we have mentioned many times here on the show, was the book that drew me back into comics after a long absence. That story is Batman Hush, and I am waiting with bated breath for next week's episode when we will be joined by Russell Sellers to review Batman Hush for you, the listening audience. However, before we get there, we thought it would be appropriate to look at other DC Comics animated features, and thus, this week's topic du jour, which I think means of the day, so it's this week's topic of the day, which doesn't make a whole hell of a lot of sense, but nonetheless, our topic this week is a countdown of the top five DC Comics animated movies.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, this one is one close to my heart, Nick. I know that DC animated movies have certainly left a mark on the industry. They've sort of dominated animated films the way that the Marvel Cinematic Universe and Marvel Studios have dominated live action films, going back, really, I guess, to the early 90s. So we've seen so many of these animated features from the representing DC Comics characters, and particularly there for about a 10-year stretch in the mid-2000s, they were just churning out great movie after great movie, Nick.
Absolutely. Like you said, going back to the early 90s, I believe 1993 was a little film that might pop up on one of our lists, and then we carry it all the way through to the current day where there's an interconnected universe of DC animated movies because they can't get one in live action to work well. So they still are coming out, what, two or three every year? Primarily still focused on Justice League, Batman, and Superman, but we're starting to see some more ancillary properties sprinkled in there. So
they actually double at one point. They were really branching out, and then they doubled back down on the Batman, Superman, Justice League movies. But now we're finally starting to see a little bit of, as you mentioned, a little bit of growth back towards that. You know, exploring the fact that there are more than just three characters in the DC universe.
Right. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how heavy our lists are on those three characters in, or those three concepts. I can't really call Justice League a character, I guess, but those three concepts in particular. So I know there's a heavy influence of one of those on my list, but we'll reveal that as we go down the road.
By the way, with the release of Hush, according to Wikipedia, there have been 35 official DC animated films, 36 if you count Mask of the Phantasm from 1993, which predates the technical DC original animated movies project from Warner Brothers. So that's a lot of movies to choose from, but I found when I narrowed down my list, the fifth spot was a little difficult, but the top four were automatic for me, and then it was just figuring out that fifth spot. What about you, Nick?
I had a list, I think, preliminarily of nine, and then there were some cuts there that were pretty easy, and then I think once it got down, I think I had like seven that I felt pretty strongly about, and I wound up having to cut two of those. So yeah, I'm sure we will talk about that, you know, near the, as we go. I'm sure there will be some on my list that aren't on yours, and vice versa.
Well, Nick, why don't you get us started this week with your number five position?
Well, I'll do that, and I'll do it in somewhat controversial fashion. Let's see if you yell at me or not about this.
I probably will,
because I'm going to cheat a little bit.
No. I know what you're going to do. I already know what you're going to do. You're combining two movies into one. I already know it.
Which they released. They later... Anyway. So, I don't remember what year this came out, even. And I don't have the Wikipedia pulled up.
Mister, I have it all on memory. I have the Wikipedia pulled up right here. And the movie that you're thinking about was released in 2012. Was the first part. 2000. And 2013 was the second part.
Yeah, so in 2012 and 2013, we got a small screen adaptation of one of the most iconic and influential, not just Batman stories of all time, but really one of the most influential comic book stories of all time. Mm-hmm. As Bruce Timm decided to bring to life The Dark Knight Returns, the seminal Frank Miller and Klaus Janson work that we have referenced so often throughout both this podcast and our days of doing the column. And one of the things that we'll talk about, or may not come up since we're covering the best of these particular movies, but one thing that has always kind of held these movies back in most cases is the runtime. Stringently holding to a somewhere between 70 and 80 minute runtime for each of these movies, it can often be an issue when they're adapting more complex stories. I know we're going to review Hush next week, and one of my major concerns going into it is, in fact, the runtime. So for Dark Knight Returns, they did something that was really brilliant. Rather than trying to constrain all of Dark Knight Returns into this one film, they decided to go two parts with it. So in 2012, we got The Dark Knight Returns Part 1. And then in 2013, we got The Dark Knight Returns Part 2. And then later in 2013, they would combine both of those into one full-length adaptation of The Dark Knight Returns. And thus, I am including on my list, Greg, the deluxe edition of Batman The Dark Knight Returns, the one single film included. It is the entire adaptation. And really, there are a lot of things I like about this, but I think it starts first and foremost with the cast. Pretty inspired casting in a lot of different with a lot of choices up and down this list. Starting at the top, Peter Weller of RoboCop fame.
Oh, yes.
He chosen to voice the elder Bruce Wayne. Now, one of the major aspects of Frank Miller's novel that didn't really wind up making the transition was the interior monologue, which some would argue, how can you do Dark Knight Returns without the interior monologue? I would argue that for this film, it wound up being the proper choice. And part of that is because Peter Weller's performance of the dialogue that was still there was so good, so incredibly good. But we got other casting choices as well. Ariel Winter, who is predominantly known for her role on Modern Family, being the voice of Carrie Kelly. She was great. Michael Emerson, best known for Lost and Person of Interest, I believe, which is
an Arrow.
An Arrow on CBS, an Arrow on CW, doing a really different take on the Joker. I kind of really liked his incarnation of the old elder version of the Joker who's come out of this coma and is now hopping back into his old ways. Mark Valley as an older Clark Kent, yeah. Conan O'Brien as David Endicrin, the late night talk show host, who played a big role in those films as well. So, or in the novel as well. So yeah, lots of great casting here. The animation is outstanding, and to their credit, they don't really, other than taking the monologues out, the interior monologues, they don't really mess with the story that much. They pretty much present Dark Knight Returns as it was, and I think one thing you and I can agree on, that when they've chosen to go the adaptation route rather than their own original stories, generally speaking, they've done better by just leaving the source material alone rather than trying to add things such as, oh, I don't know, the prologue to Killing Joke and stuff like that. So big time ups for me on this one. I love this adaptation. Hard to go wrong with adapting one of the greatest Batman stories of all time. So Batman, The Dark Knight Returns, the deluxe edition is number 5 on my list.
One of the best examples, Nick, of them directly adapting a story. Right. Certainly. Like, Peter Weller was awesome, as you mentioned. Mark Valley was a great Superman. This very nearly made my list. This is certainly one of the best animated features they've done. Very faithful to the source material. I think what ultimately held it off my list is that, unlike some people, I'm not a dirty cheater, and so I was looking at them as separate films, and I thought part one was stronger than part two. But both were good. Both were good. So, but to prove my point, Nick, that I'm not just name-calling here, on my number 5, I did not take the easy way out, because I took a 2-part movie and only used the first part as released on its own. My number 5 film is The Death of Superman.
Recency bias. That's what you've fallen into.
Perhaps so. But 2018 film, directed by Sam Liu and James Tucker, two guys with great pedigrees in directing animation. James Tucker, of course, you probably recognize that name if you're a fan of Justice League and Justice League Unlimited. He was one of that vaunted creators room that sort of drove that show, produced the show, helped come up with a lot of the great ideas. Sam Liu has directed numerous of the animated features for DC and Warner Brothers. And while this had been tried before, adapting The Death of Superman numerous times, there was a Justice League episode that attempted to use Doomsday and do a similar fight that didn't necessarily end the same way. There was an attempt to do it with the Superman Doomsday film, which was actually, believe it or not, Nick, the film that kicked off the modern era of Warner Brothers animation way back in, I think, 2006, maybe. And that movie didn't work.
Yeah, I remember that one, mainly for the special features more so than anything else.
Oh, yes. Excellent special features on that one. As a movie, it didn't really work. It had a great Doomsday and Superman fight scene in it. But after that, the movie kind of fell off the wheels fell off for the movie. But this was supposedly an attempt by the studio to do it right, to do service to the classic, most bought storyline in the history of DC Comics, The Death of Superman. And I gotta say, as a kid that, I've told this story before, when I read the issue when it came out, The Death of Superman, and I cried as an 8-year-old boy reading the story, I gotta say, they got it right for the most part. This one was, and I'll tell you what gave them a leg up, and what's a running theme on a lot of these movies that are on my list, Nick. The writer for this one was Peter Tomasi, And what I found on my as I researched my list is the movies that tend to stand out to me are the ones that were written by or had a very strong hand in the writing process by comic book writers. Because they understand these characters, they know these characters, they love these characters more than anyone else, and they know what makes these characters tick. So Tomasi wrote it. But what made this work where the first attempt at it failed so miserably with the Superman Doomsday movie? Well, first of all, they were coming up against a little bit of a handicap in this because it is set firmly in the, I don't know what you officially call this continuity, Nick, the DC animated movie universe is what it says on Wikipedia. The DC animated movie universe, which started with the Flashpoint Paradox a few years ago. And to be honest, we've talked about this on the show, Nick. We've talked about it offline as well. I've not been the biggest fan of this new animated universe. It's very tight continuity, which I'm a sucker for, but the animation style has not been to my liking. A lot of the stories have felt flat to me, especially compared to the brilliant work that they were doing earlier in the decade, as we'll talk about. But this one was a course correction. This felt like it was made with so much heart and so much, again, understanding and love of the characters, and not just the modern interpretation of what we were getting in the New 52, which inspired this new animated universe, but kind of moving away from that and moving back to the heart of these characters. And I think first and foremost, this movie repositions Clark Kent and Lois Lane as the romance of the DC universe, as it should be. Jerry O'Connell plays Superman here, as he's been doing in this universe for some time now. And notably, Rebecca Romijn steps in to play Lois. And this is a Lois that is fierce, strong, independent, and someone who is every bit the equal of Clark Kent. And you can see why he's so drawn to her. And their romance really takes center stage in The Death of Superman. It's not just a movie about a monster arriving and killing the hero. It's a romance. It's a story about love, and it's a story about sacrifice. And it's the first time in this new animated universe that Superman has felt like Superman. There are also these great moments throughout the movie of levity, where in the midst of this terrible battle between the Justice League and Doomsday, there are moments where the writing sort of takes the piss out of the New 52 cliches at times. For instance, there's a comment about the Wonder Woman and Superman relationship. And I think there's a line even in the dialogue where someone, I can't remember if it was Wonder Woman that actually refers to it as it kind of creepy, actually. At one point she says, it's kind of weird that we even did that in the first place. And so there are these little cute moments throughout the story where they're poking fun at some of the missteps that they've made along the way in the animated universe. But at the end of the day, this is truly about Superman and the people that he affects around him. Bibbo Bobrowski, I remember I was so thrilled just to see Bibbo pop up at one point. Jimmy Olsen is given a prominent role. Lois Lane plays a prominent role. We also get the introduction of Hank Henshaw, and his whole origin story plays out here almost exactly as it did in the comics. Or at least very similar. So, Lex Luthor is in this, played by Rainn Wilson, and he takes the most getting used to. I was not sold on Rainn Wilson's Lex Luthor, and he's still not going to be my favorite, but he adds a little bit of a creepy menace to Lex. It's a little bit of a different take than maybe we're used to, and I enjoyed it. The whole thing is a love letter to this storyline. There are some limitations because of, they're trying to fit it into this universe. So you get the actual proper Justice League as opposed to Guy Gardner, Ice, Fire, Blue Beetle, and that team from the comic book. And ultimately, you get that tragedy. And as I remember, I was watching this with Russell at his place. And I remember I said, God, man, I was getting legitimately emotional at this climax of this movie, which is hard to do for these animated films, especially when you know it's coming. But they did such a good job of breathing life into these characters. And an all-star cast, really. You got Rosario Dawson as Wonder Woman, Nathan Fillion as Green Lantern, Shamar Moore as Cyborg. Just a lot of great name talent here playing roles to the best of their ability. So, and the animation is great. The fighting scenes are terrific, especially compared to some of the movies we've gotten just prior to this one. So, long story short, Death of Superman is my number 5. I did consider combining it with Reign of the Superman, but to be honest, though I liked Reign of the Superman, it was not to the level of quality of Death of Superman, so I kept them separate.
Interesting. This is one I have not seen, as you know, mm-hmm. But I am looking forward to catching up at some point and giving this one a chance. So, moving on to my number 4, and I'm going to take it back a little bit, not all the way back, as we referenced.
Take it back.
But I'm going to go back to the year 2000 and back to the old classic DC animated universe, not the animated film universe, but the universe of animated series. As you remember, Batman the Animated Series, Superman the Animated Series, Justice League. But there was another series in that universe, Batman Beyond. And Batman Beyond gave us one direct-to-DVD animated movie that I, you know, as someone who's never been the biggest fan in the world of Batman Beyond, I think this is that series' lasting contribution. I think this is its story that holds up right on par with some of the best that the DC animated universe ever produced. And I am speaking, of course, of Batman Beyond: Return of the Joker. Like I said, direct to DVD came out in December of 2000. An edited version as a response to the tragedy at Columbine, which had seen obviously some school violence going on back in 1999. And then the uncut version was later released in 2002. So for the most part, I'm going to talk about the uncut version here. Let's start with one of the best casts. I mean, anytime you talk about that old DC animated universe, you got to talk about the cast. Let's run it down real quick. Kevin Conroy back as Bruce Wayne. Mark Hamill as the Joker. Will Friedle as Terry McGinnis or Batman Beyond. Tara Strong as a young Barbara Gordon. Arlene Sorkin as Harley Quinn. Melissa Joan Hart as Delia and Deidre Dennis, the Dee Dee twins. Michael Rosenbaum as Batman Beyond villain Ghoul. Henry Rollins as Batman Beyond villain Bonk. So just an outstanding cast here for this one. But really what brings this home for me and makes it a slam, it was one of the ones that I knew was going to be a lock to make my list. And that's largely because of the screenplay from Paul Dini, based off a story from Paul Dini, Glenn Murakami, and Bruce Timm, an original story they create here that takes the character of Tim Drake, who was used obviously in the new Batman Adventures, and kind of imagines what might have happened to Tim Drake after the events of Batman the Animated Series and the new Batman Adventures. Also taking a look at, you know, in Batman Beyond, we meet Bruce Wayne, who has retired from crime fighting, and this kind of uses a flashback approach to tell us both a modern, a story set in the Batman Beyond timeline, while also giving us a glimpse at what exactly happened that made Bruce Wayne give up the cape and cowl. And it is eventually revealed to us that the Joker was able to kidnap and mentally torture and reprogram Tim Drake. For an animated film, this is one of the darkest and most psychologically complex stories they've ever attempted to tell, and they do it beautifully. As we see the Joker break down Tim Drake, turning him into his own twisted version of what a Robin would be to the Joker. We subsequently get to see Tim Drake. He is responsible for committing, you know, the one act that Batman never would, as he pulls a gun and she literally murders this version of the Joker. The DC animated universe version of the Joker meets his end due to a gunshot fired by Tim Drake. But the Joker all along has one last joke left to play, and that is, of course, that he has installed his consciousness onto a microchip that he's planted at the base of Tim Drake's skull. And so many years later, when the Joker is running around New Gotham, haunting Batman seemingly from beyond the grave and causing Bruce to have to stir up all these old memories, these unpleasant memories of what drove him out of crime fighting, the ultimate reveal at the end that it is in fact Tim Drake who was behind all of this. It is a heartbreaking story throughout. It does more to make me feel for Tim Drake than just about any other Tim Drake story I've ever read. It's that good. And props to Paul Denny and his writing of Terry McGinnis. I would argue this does enough to justify Terry McGinnis. You know, I'm, again, not the biggest Batman Beyond fan in the world, never really understood the need for it, but this story almost in and of itself justifies the entire exercise. So basically, for that Joker and Tim Drake stuff, this finds the number four spot on my list. But this was, like, as I said, a lock. I knew this had to be on there. It is one that I have come to appreciate immensely more each and every time I see it. So hoping to do a rewatch of this one here soon, now that my memory's been jogged on it.
Yeah, one of the most twisted animated features I can ever remember a comic book company putting out there. I mean, we've seen some pretty twisted stuff in recent years, but keep in mind, this was 2000. This was not when you would expect to see this. I mean, I remember Batman the Animated Series was known for kind of pushing the envelope with blood and violence and things of that nature, but we had never seen anything like Return of the Joker when it came out. The psychological aspects of this. And like you said, I'm somebody that I've never been a big fan of Batman Beyond. I've never been a big fan of Tim Drake in particular, but this movie made me a fan of both. It really did. It caused me to look at Terry McGinnis in a different light, and particularly it caused me to look at Tim Drake in a different light and get such a twisted take on him that really was compelling to watch. And certainly, Nick, this is a worthy addition to the list. It did not make mine, but it's certainly worthy of any top five list or top ten list of animated movies. It's certainly one of the best usages of Robin in general as a character, no matter who's under the cowl. So check this one out if you haven't seen it, folks. I don't know where it's available right now, if it's streaming anywhere. It may be on DC Universe, actually.
Yeah, I was about to say, I believe it is. I could be mistaken, though.
And hopefully it's the uncut version. Because you really need to see it. I the first version of this I saw was the edited version, and it's not the same as when you watch the unedited director's cut. Excellent stuff, Nick. Well, for my number four, I'm going to fast forward about 8 years from your number four, and this is going to continue my line of stories with a heavy creative input put from comic book writers. In particular, my choice for number four is Justice League: The New Frontier. This came out in 2008, written by Stan Berkowitz for the screenplay, but based on the heavy input and the story of Darwin Cook. Darwin actually helped with the script here, helped with the story, and was the visual consultant. He storyboarded this movie for DC Animation. Directed by a guy named Dave Bullock, who I frankly never heard of, but he did an awesome job in this one. So this is an adaptation, of course, of probably Darwin Cook's most famous and lasting work, The New Frontier. And it is an imagining of superheroes by way of the space age, sort of that idyllic Silver Age look at the birth of superheroes. And in particular, this gives us the classic wartime versions of or Korean War era superheroes of Superman, Wonder Woman, and Batman, who existed at the time. And sort of our point of view character for a lot of this is Hal Jordan. Mm-hmm. So obviously, this movie is after my own heart. It is one of the best Hal Jordan stories that you will ever find in any medium. You know, we get the classic 50s and or 60s Justice League here. We get appearances from Adam Strange, from Aquaman, from John Jones, who is awesome here. And
I would argue he's probably the second, you know, the yeah. secondary point of the character in
yeah.
this one.
As Detective John Jones undercover with the Gotham City PD. Again, an incredible cast. So here's just some of the cast members here. Jeremy Sisto as Bruce Wayne / Batman. David Boreanaz as Hal Jordan. Miguel Ferrer as John Jones. Miguel Ferreira, a lot of people might know from RoboCop as well, tying it into Dark Knight Returns earlier. Neil Patrick Harris as The Flash. Lucy Lawless as Wonder Woman. Kyle MacLachlan as Superman. I mean, this is Kira Sedgwick, the closer, if you will, Nick, as Lois Lane. Brooke Shields as Carol Ferris. Upgrade. I mean, this is pretty amazing. Corey Burton, who I think voiced Brainiac on Superman the Animated Series and Justice League, portrays Abin Sur in this movie. We get all in, this movie is just after our nerd hearts, Nick, because we get a Hal Jordan origin, we get a Justice League origin, and it's a period piece. It's so bold to make it a period piece, as Darwin did in his graphic novel, his comic book series. And this is just one of the best that DC has ever put out. The writing is so precise. The writing is so impactful. If you see the movie, you will never forget. You will never forget the scene with Batman and Martian Manhunter in Martian Manhunter's apartment. It's, to this day, my favorite interaction between those two characters. And the classic line of, all I need is a book. All I need is a book of matches. I mean, that's pretty immortal line and a pretty immortal scene in the canon of both characters. And again, we talked earlier, Nick, about how DC animation has tended to just be Batman movies, Superman movies, and Justice League movies. And this is a Justice League movie, but it's truly a Justice League movie and not one in name alone, because it doesn't make Batman the focus. It doesn't make Superman or Wonder Woman the focus. It makes the ancillary characters the focus. Characters like Rick Flagg, characters like King Faraday, characters like, you know, as I mentioned, Abin Sur, Adam Strange, Green Arrow shows up, Iris West, Barry Allen. It was wonderful to see all these characters thrown in there, and maybe people becoming a fan of the Martian Manhunter, who they'd never heard of before, perhaps. I just thought it was wonderful. I think it's one of the best animated films that DC's ever done. Have you ever seen a better example, Nick, of translating the visual style of a comic book, specific visual style of a comic book, to animation like this? It was like Darwin Cook was hand animating the entire thing.
It really was. It was remarkable, the animation here, as they attempted to ape that style. Yeah.
And so in the end, I thought this was one of my locks. This was, when I made this list, I knew this was going to be one of my locks, and I pretty well knew it would come in at number 4 for me, just behind some of these other ones. It was jockeying with my number 3 movie before I ultimately made that call. But yeah, this one had to make it. Still one of the best to this very day.
This was actually my number 6. It was between this and Dark Knight Returns, and I ultimately went with Dark Knight Returns, but I can understand. I mean, this was very, very close for me as well, so good choice there. Moving on to, stop me if you've heard this one, but another Batman entry on my list, and one that I feel certain is probably going to pop up on yours as well. Let's go over to the year 2010. And let's talk about Batman Under the Red Hood. This comes in at number 3 on my list. Obviously, this is a fairly I don't know how loose of an adaptation it was. I would say it does a pretty good job of adapting the Under the Hood Judd Winnick story from the Batman monthly comic. And that story was, of course, one that saw Jason Todd return to the land of the living after many years. Now, in the comic, it was because Superboy Prime punched a hole in reality. In this movie, I would argue they do they give it the much better version of Drish dropped him into a Lazarus pit, which is much better. But this film is kind of fighting uphill, because Under the Hood is able to rely on decades of Batman storytelling that preceded it. And what I mean by that is, specifically, it is able to call back to the classic story, A Death in the Family, and utilize the years of storytelling that came after that to serve as the emotional foundation on which this Under the Hood story will be built. Under the Red Hood has to fight uphill a little bit, because it's got to give you this prologue where we see the events of A Death in the Family happen. And I think it was right there with the prologue that this movie kind of grabbed me and signaled that it was never going to let me go, because it's there that we meet not just Bruce Greenwood as Batman, who is outstanding, by the way, and it was a great contribution, giving, you know, lending his talents to the role, and I'm so glad he's able to, been able to reprise that role in other projects, namely Young Justice. It also gave us an introduction to John DiMaggio as the Joker. Now, in terms of animated adaptations of the Joker, the list must begin. The Alpha and the Omega is Mark Hamill. There's no one else who will ever be able to touch him. But I would argue that John DiMaggio does a damn good job and is arguably the only other person I've ever heard do it who doesn't come off like he's doing a bad Mark Hamill imitation and is able to put his own spin on the role while having it be good at the same time. I know Young Justice had a version of the character that was terrible with the voice affectation that was chosen there. I know other video games, Arkham Origins most notably, has had other actors take on the role, but they've been doing, again, Mark Hamill impressions. John DiMaggio brings a level of menace to the Joker that you wouldn't really expect, knowing him predominantly for the role of Bender on Futurama. So,
name Bender Bending Rodriguez.
There you go. So, but this one also, after that prologue that sets up the events of the film and introduces you to that death of Jason Todd, what it looks like in this film, we also get a damn good cast that rounds out around it, namely Neil Patrick Harris as Nightwing. Really the only Batman animated film that's had a major role for Nightwing ever. And I know that's something that you'll probably talk about here in a little bit. Wade Williams as an outstanding Roman Sionis / Black Mask. Absolutely wonderful. And then, of course, you can't talk about Under the Red Hood without talking about Jensen Ackles, who does a wonderful incarnation of Jason Todd here, filling his voice with the righteous anger, honestly, in my opinion, righteous anger that he has towards Batman and the Joker for the years of stories that have played out since what happened to him with the crowbar overseas all those years ago. So this is a story that really sees Batman and sees Bruce put through the emotional ringer. And as you know, that's what I'm looking for in all my favorite Batman stories first and foremost, is I want to see Bruce emotionally tortured. I want to see that guilt leaned into. And what's great about this story is the guilt is here. He's feeling it. And he absolutely 100% should be, in my opinion. A lot of Batman stories, you know, feature Batman, you know, fretting over and dwelling on mistakes that he's made, but that were just those mistakes. At a certain point, this wasn't a mistake anymore. The issue, Jason's issue really in the film, isn't so much that he let him die, it's that he never really did anything about it. For the years since, the Joker and Batman have been still locked in this same old struggle, this same old constant cycle of the Joker does something, Batman puts him away, and a few months later he breaks out, and here we go again. And Jason says that near the end of the film in his monologue. You know, I'm not asking you to kill Dent or the Penguin or the Riddler or anybody else, just him. If only because he took me away from you. And that whole scene near the end is expertly done by all the major players, Bruce Greenwood, Jensen Ackles, and John DiMaggio. Throughout the film, it is just a roller coaster. It is one that, at first glance, you would be worried about that 72-minute runtime. I think this one clocks in at right at 75 minutes. Perfect. And yet, I would argue, it's kind of the perfect runtime for this film. If I was going to change, you know, anything, maybe it would be a series of Batman films that could have, you know, led into this, but that's a minor nitpick because, like I said, that prologue is so good at establishing the story, hard to complain too much. So, yeah, this takes home the number three spot on my list.
And to your point about that scene at the end and about that grieving process and about that self-hate, one of the best scenes in this movie and probably my favorite ending of any animated movie, and I'll say more about this movie in a little bit. I don't want to telegraph too much here, but that last scene, Nick, where he goes into the cave and Alfred goes into the cave and says, "I'll be removing Master Jason's costume," and then Bruce stops him and says, "This changes nothing. What happened with me and Jason with the Red Hood thing changes absolutely nothing. Bruce is not ever going to forget what happened. He's never going to forget his role in what happened, and it's really truly heartbreaking and touching, and a rare glimpse into Bruce Wayne's humanity.
Absolutely. So what's your number three?
My number three, and I'm not sure how much I cut out there, but my number three is from 2009, and it is directed by Lauren Montgomery, and it is Wonder Woman.
Hmm.
One that I still think you haven't seen, Nick, if I'm not mistaken.
I've seen it, but I saw it once, like, very late at night, and admittedly wasn't paying close attention.
Yeah, this one, directed by Lauren Montgomery, screenplay by Michael Jelinek, based on, are you ready, a story by Gail Simone. So Gail Simone, another comic book writer, kind of laid out the story here, which is heavily based on George Perez's post-crisis Wonder Woman reboot, the Gods and Mortals story arc. And it involves Wonder Woman's conflict with the god of war, Ares. And Ares subsequently bringing Hades into the equation as well. And in this case, it also involves Wonder Woman's origin and her meeting of Steve Trevor. This was, for a lot of people, including myself, the first real Wonder Woman origin story they had ever seen. I had never encountered a Wonder Woman origin story in the comics before. This was the first. I was new to all of this knowledge. I had read about things online. I knew the basics that Steve Trevor was, crash landed in Themyscira, and you know they had an on again, off again romance over the years and things of that nature. I knew certainly that she was in the Greek god pantheon. That whole mythology dealt with that, and I knew some of her rogues, and I knew the character of Artemis, but I didn't know the details. I didn't know how all these characters intermingled, and keeping in mind that this movie was coming out a decade before the live-action movie came out, almost, that this was coming out before any prominent major female-led superhero project. I mean, certainly you'd have Catwoman and Elektra and things like that, but this was the most iconic woman superhero that we've seen in comics, either company, DC or Marvel. This is the one that they had to get right. And I think they absolutely knocked it out of the park. I think it's one of the best Wonder Woman stories I've encountered still to this day. It really encapsulates all the great moments of her origin. I thought the live-action movie, by the way, actually took some elements from this animated feature and did a good job with it. But Lauren Montgomery does such a brilliant job of bridging these excellent animation sequences with these human moments that make you understand and feel for these characters and learn who Diana is and feel that Diana is both a bringer of peace and, when necessary, a bringer of war, but only when necessary. The cast here is, again, sensational. The casting, I believe Andre Romano did all the casting for these movies, and it's bang on. Kerry Russell as Wonder Woman is spectacular. Instantly nails the voice. Nathan Fillion, the perpetual favorite of comic book fandom, Nick, plays Steve Trevor here, and he's outstanding. He kind of actually, in a weird way, has that same Chris Pine attitude, that sort of, cavalier, not really sure how to react to what's going on around him kind of attitude, and it's just perfect for this version of Steve Trevor. Alfred Molina as Ares. Of course, Alfred Molina had already become a big name for comic book fans, having played Doc Ock in Spider-Man 2. Rosario Dawson as Artemis. I know Nick's favorite actress, Marg Helgenberger as Hera. Just go with it, Nick. And the legendary Oliver Platt as Hades. Pretty good, pretty inspired choices all around here. John DiMaggio, of course, pops up as Deimos. And there's just an outstanding amount of talent gathered here to portray these characters and do it in such a way where when this movie ends, if you're not a Wonder Woman fan, there's something wrong with you. This movie ended and I was instantly like, I got to get my hands on some more Wonder Woman stories. And I subsequently read some stories by Gail Simone, some stories by George Perez, some stories by some others. But in particular, this movie put a light on her relationship to the other Amazons and carve them out as a unique niche in the DC universe. Kind of like Green Lantern has, you know, the cosmos as sort of his playground. Batman has Gotham City. Superman has Metropolis. Wonder Woman's sort of living world was this Themyscira. And showing that Paradise Island is this real place inhabited by an interesting culture that's totally different from ours. And I found it fascinating. If you can find this one, go check it out. I think it's on DC Universe as well. Go watch this one. It's one of the best that they've ever done. And still, it's close with this in the live-action film as to which one is my preferred treatment of Wonder Woman. They're both great in their own way. But I would definitely recommend giving this one a watch. It certainly brings home the climactic action sequence better than the live-action film did.
Interesting. It's one that I need to revisit. We have it here. I have it for my kids, but I guess I need to take another look at some point here in the near future. Moving on to my number two. Here's one that I don't want to speak for you, but I'm fairly sure this is about to be your painting, but maybe I'm wrong. My list, as you know, as you anyone can tell, has been dominated thus far by Batman films. But I'm going to go here to a different DC hero, and I'm going to go to June of 2011 when we got not our first look at a Green Lantern animated movie, but our second look at a Green Lantern animated film, as we got Green Lantern Emerald Knights. And what was great about this one is, rather than attempting to carry on from what I would argue was a flawed foundation set by Green Lantern First Flight, this film kind of, you could technically view this as a sequel to First Flight if you really wanted to, but mm-hmm. for the most part, you can kind of just dispense, you know, just discard First Flight. You don't really need it to understand this film. And what this does a great job of is expanding on the Green Lantern mythos and showing you that it's more than just the Green Lantern of Earth. It's more than just this one character. It really is an expansive mythology with thousands of characters, thousands of worlds, and each one being their own unique setup.
And it is also my painting.
It is also your painting. What this does great is it's one of the few DC animated films to use the anthology format, and it gives us a variety of different stories, some taking their inspiration from classic Green Lantern stories and some taking inspiration from Green Lantern stories that aren't as well known. Mogo Doesn't Socialize, most notably, is the big one that's adapted here, telling the story of Bolfunga the Unrelented. We also get a loose adaptation of Alan Moore's Tigers, as we see this prophecy of what will come. We get to see Lyra, a character who played heavily during the Geoff Johns run, and kind of what her origins it was. We get to see the origins of Kilowog. We get to see the throwback all the way to the early days of the Corps with the First Lantern. And throughout all this, we are introduced to all these fascinating characters, voiced in expert fashion, in many cases, by a voice cast, once again put together by Andrea Romano, starting at the top with Nathan Fillion as Hal Jordan. I know internet culture and geek culture had been begging for Nathan Fillion to do anything comic book related, it feels like, for years.
And in particular, and here he is, Hal Jordan was always...
in particular,
yeah.
Hal Jordan. So here he is. We also get Elizabeth Moth as Aresia, Jason Isaacs as Sinestro, Henry Rollins as an outstanding Kilowog, and our personal favorite, I think, in the film,
yes,
Rowdy Roddy Piper as Bolfunga the Unrelenting. Outstanding stuff here, and really a good, you know, only, let's see, what's the runtime on this? 84 minutes. At 84 minutes, it's the perfect length to give to someone who knows nothing about Green Lantern and kind of use it as a showcase of, this is why I like this.
Oh, so, yeah. Absolutely. No, you it is my painting, and everything you just said about the movie is, I 100% agree with. This is what I would give to somebody that's not a Green Lantern fan, that doesn't understand it, that doesn't get the appeal of it. I wouldn't give them the live-action movie for sure. I wouldn't give them First Flight. I wouldn't even give them a comic book necessarily, because I think that the best way to enjoy Green Lantern is if you understand what it is going in, and then you could get into that great Geoff Johns run. Maybe Secret Origin could do that as well, But I feel like that Geoff Johns run is so wonderful if you actually read it from Rebirth and then read Secret Origin in its proper place as sort of a flashback tale. This movie really condenses the joys of Green Lantern. Because maybe you're not a Hal Jordan fan. Maybe you're one of those hellions out there that listens to our show who isn't a Hal Jordan fan. And if you are not a Hal Jordan fan, you might watch this movie and become a fan of Abin Sur, or become a fan of Lyra, or become a fan of Kilowog, or damn sure become a fan of Mogo. So you're taking it in this anthology approach, and I would argue this is the way to approach Green Lantern in general, because there is truly something for everyone in Green Lantern. There is a character for you, I promise you. Maybe it's Jessica Cruz, maybe it's Guy Gardner, maybe it's Simon Baz, maybe it's Jon Stewart. There is a character for you. And taking this anthology approach allows us to view so many amazing characters. We get to view Chip in this movie, Nick, for God's sake. And we get to see little lanterns as small as a virus. We get to see lanterns as large as a planet. We get to see one of the original stories for this movie is actually called The First Lantern, and it's really, really well done. It's this touching story of this, the idea that courage is what defines a Green Lantern over anything else, the ability to overcome great fear. And it gets that across through this alien character that you're actually instantly connected to. You get the Kilowog, which is an adaptation of a Pete Tomasi story. And I believe that Pete Tomasi actually wrote this adaptation of that story. In fact, I know he did. And it's this brilliant adaptation of a wonderful story about Kilowog and his drill instructor, who is clearly based on Arlie Ermey, right? So
yes.
And we get to see that to wonderful, wonderful effect here. And from there, we go from there to the classic Alan Moore adaptations you mentioned. Actually, we have Lyra in between there, and that was one of the standouts of this. Some of the best animation you will ever see in your life, by the way, is in the Lyra or Lyra short here, where she has a battle with her dad, and it is amazing. The animation is smooth as can be. It's one of the best fight scenes choreography-wise that I've ever seen in animation, any studio. This is a masterpiece. The colors throughout this entire movie are perfect, and that's so important in a Green Lantern project. Mogo Doesn't Socialize and Abin Sur are the Alan Moore adaptations, and they're wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Dave Gibbons actually wrote one of those for the movie. Rowdy Roddy Piper as Bullfunga, you could not have cast that any better. Jason Isaacs as Sinestro, you could not have cast that any better. Nathan Fillion as Hal Jordan also applies. Kelly Hugh as Lyra, could not have cast that any better. Just a brilliant movie. And then, of course, in the end, after the Abin Sur story, you get the big fight with Krona. And the biggest disappointment of this movie, Nick, the one thing that disappoints me, is that the seeds are sown for a sequel, and it never happened. And I think it never happened because the live-action movie flopped so miserably. And it damaged the brand, and so they gave up on it. But gosh, man, this is the way to do a Green Lantern movie. I think you'd agree with this, Nick. This is the way to do a Green Lantern movie. This approach, this idea of embracing the weird, embracing the unique, embracing the fact that this is a cosmic character who encounters alien creatures. Because people will root for aliens. They don't have to just be humans in order for people to root for them. And I think that, especially in a post-Guardians of the Galaxy world, Nick, it remains eternally frustrating that Warner Brothers has not taken a look at something like this and realized what they have with the Green Lantern universe.
Absolutely. Could not agree more. Moving on to my number one, and I am going to go all the way back. We referenced earlier that DC animated films kind of got their start back in the early 90s. Well, that would be 1993 in particular, and it would be up until The Killing Joke, the only of these films to receive an actual theatrical release. So I am speaking, of course, of Batman Mask of the Phantasm. Mask of the Phantasm was originally conceived as a direct-to-video animated feature that was going to capitalize on the massive success of the first season of Batman the Animated Series. And eventually Warner Brothers had enough faith to greenlight it for a theatrical release, but had so little faith that they decided to dump it out on Christmas Day with virtually no promotion attached to it. And what kind of got lost back in that time, and it's kind of been appreciated by fans ever since, is that this probably was, at the time, from 1993 going forward for several years, it was probably the best theatrically released Batman film that had ever been made. And it starts once again with the cast. We're talking about that classic cast of Kevin Conroy, Mark Hamill as the Joker, Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. as Alfred, getting perhaps more to do in this film than he has in most other films, because what this film does is it takes you back to the early days of Bruce Wayne, and he is a man who is living, trying to decide what he's going to become, as we see in these flashbacks, what actions he is going to take to he's toying with that idea of avenging his parents in some way, honoring his parents in some way, but while also still holding on to that hope that he could live a normal life. And it isn't until he meets a woman named Andrea Beaumont and they have a failed engagement that Bruce convinces himself there's no way to have a normal life. There's no way to do what he feels like he needs to do and also function in society the way that it is expected of him. And it is there that we kind of see the Batman the Animated Series version of the Father, I Shall Become a Bat thing. Not directly adapted from the Frank Miller Year One story, but a close approximation. And then, of course, in the modern context, as the story plays out across two timelines, we see the return of Andrea Beaumont to Gotham. And in true Todd Webber enraging fashion, she winds up being this mysterious character, the Phantasm, just right around the same time that she's there in Gotham. And we eventually find out that her parents were taken from her the same way that Bruce's were from him. And it sets up this dual narrative of seeing how these two characters, who under normal circumstances would be perfect for each other, each are responding to their own trauma in different ways. And it is causing this conflict between them that ultimately can't be resolved. And caught in between these two figures, you have Mark Hamill as the Joker, who is just able to cut loose in a way that he really wasn't able to on the animated series for, standards and practices and whatnot. For a theatrical film, you can get a little darker. I know there's a scene in an amusement park in particular that still is kind of creepy if you watch it to this day. It's really just an outstanding story, and it's a rare example of the animated series did it once with Harley Quinn, of getting to add a wholly original creation to the Batman pantheon, and they essentially now have done it twice. The Phantasm hasn't been used a ton in the years since, but I know Tom King is getting ready to dust her off in his Batman Catwoman series. It's going to release later this year. So multiple original creations given to us by the brilliant Paul Dini, and perhaps this film might be his best work of all on the character.
It's a classic. It's a classic that certainly laid the foundations of everything that came since, giving us, I remember, the Joker bleeding and having his teeth knocked out, which was a big deal at the time to me as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I rented this movie so many times from Blockbuster, it's ridiculous. It definitely it laid the foundations. I would argue that it maybe doesn't hold up quite as well as we have in our memories for it, but it's still a really good movie, no doubt. And certainly worthy of inclusion on a list such as ours. Which brings me to my number one, and you've already talked about it. You've pretty much said most of what there is to say about it, but my number one is another Batman film. I know there's a lot of Batman involvement, particularly from Nick's list, but even from mine as well. And
well, he's had the most bites at the apple. I mean, really, they've released more Batman films than any other.
Very true. So, and actually, I'm proud. This is my only Batman film on my list, now that I'm looking at it. But, of course, he was in New Frontier and Death of Superman. But my number one is Batman Under the Red Hood. Directed by Brandon Vietti, who would go on to co-create Young Justice. So he knows what the hell he's doing with animation. He directed it, produced by Bruce Timm, of course, and written by the same guy that wrote the comic book. Imagine that, Nick. Judd Winnick. Judd Winnick wrote Batman Under the Hood, as you mentioned, as an ongoing story arc in his Batman run in, I want to say, 2003 and 4. Might have been 2004 and 5. But this, that was his baby. That was his storyline. And so he somehow got the gig from Warner Brothers Animation to adapt that story to the small screen. And he goes about this and he takes this as a challenge, not just to take what he had already done, but to improve what he had already done. And for that, I've made this claim before, Nick. I actually think the animated movie is better than the comic book story. And I like the comic book story a lot. I always have. But I think that sometimes trimming the fat out can help stories. And that is 100% the case with Under the Red Hood. Because with, as you mentioned, that 75-minute runtime, a lot of times that is an albatross. We view it as an albatross on these movies. However, Judd Winnick looks at this as a challenge. What can I cut out? What is unnecessary to my story? What things can I change to make this story work? And you could tell that he poured his heart and soul into this movie. You could tell it in the special features. You could tell it just in the way this movie is put together. Judd Winnick fixed the problems with Batman Under the Hood, whether it was the Superman, the Superboy Prime punch, whether it was the sort of meandering build to Jason's public reveal. Everything is crisp and tight here, and to his eternal credit, the character that he kind of thrusts in here as the, not necessarily the POV character, but the everyman character here, is my favorite comic book character of all time, Dick Grayson, played wonderfully by Neil Patrick Harris. And you've also heard me tell you this, Nick, this is the best version of Dick Grayson that we've ever gotten. Movies, TV, animation, this is the best version of Dick Grayson that we've gotten outside the comics. Neil Patrick Harris is perfect, perfect in this role. I want more of this version of Nightwing moving forward. I don't know that we'll ever get it. I don't know that we'll ever get a sequel to this movie, but he is my favorite part of it. He's so, he captures the whimsy of Dick Grayson, the optimism of Dick Grayson, but he can also be a badass, and he can also, he can be the best parts of Batman while also not giving in to the grief and the torture and the agony of that defines Bruce Wayne. And Bruce Greenwood as that tortured Batman who can't and won't accept that this is Jason Todd, who can't and won't accept that his son has come back to life and is this monster and that it's his fault. John DiMaggio as this really sadistic version of the Joker, this really leaning into the serial killer psychotic aspects of the character. He's perfect. The Ra's al Ghul in his, I believe, portrayed by Jason Isaacs here. Yes, Jason Isaacs is Ra's. And when he's here, he's got that sort of nobility, that royal nature that Ra's has in the comics and in the animated series. And you can also tell when Bruce is coming to him at the beginning of the movie that sense that he's like, I've gone too far. I've gone too far this time with what I've done. The prologue that sets everything up, the epilogue, the most beautiful epilogue in any of these animated movies, where the last shot of the film is that heartbreaking close-up shot of Bruce and Jason together swinging through the streets of Gotham or hanging out with one another. It's just, it's still to this day, when I rewatched this movie about a year and a half ago, I think, maybe a year ago, and it was every bit as impactful as it was the first time I watched it. It is a classic, animated classic, a Batman classic. Go out of your way to watch this movie. I guarantee you won't be disappointed. It's the rare example of taking the source material and elevating it rather than either trying to match it or, most of the time, underperforming. And hell, man, with this sort of pedigree, I don't know why Judd Winnick hasn't gotten a chance to write a live action movie yet for DC. They could probably do a hell of a lot worse and have done.
Those are animated films, yeah. Guys. Greg, those are direct to DVD films. Completely different.
Completely different. They're not worthy of getting a crack at the big time. That's right. They can go off to their corner, like Gustin and his crew can go off to their corner, and do their damn TV thing. What a stupid mentality. Anyway, sorry WB officials if you're listening.
No, you're not.
No, I'm not. Anyway, that's been my list, and that was Nick's list, and we want to see your lists. So send them in through Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. Join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, and let us see your list. What are your top five DC animated movies? I know a lot of people are high on Flashpoint. There are several that we could have brought up here. That
Yeah, Flashpoint was considered for mine as well.
A lot of people are high on Flashpoint. A lot of people are high on Superman, Batman, Public Enemies, and Apocalypse. Both good movies. What's another one that people are really high on? Batman Year One was one that deserved consideration. Justice League Doom had consideration for my list. Just a really fun movie. Superman versus the Elite was awesome.
I always liked Crisis on Two Earths.
Oh, yeah. That was a good one, too.
James Woods is Owlman.
Yeah, that was good, too. I just thought – I think it's maybe a little bit below Doom for me, but they're both really good. Superman versus the Elite was really good. Then you get into the – Batman Assault on Arkham. Did you ever see that one?
I still haven't seen it. I haven't seen it yet.
So good. Really shockingly good. Throne of Atlantis was okay. I don't know why I even mentioned that one. Bad Blood was good. I watched that one just last year. That was good. Justice League versus Teen Titans was pretty good. Teen Titans Judas Contract was good. Batman and Harley Quinn was good.
Now Greg is just reading the entire list of films.
No, I'm skipping over several. And then I haven't seen a few of these. Justice League versus Fatal Five. Gotham by Gaslight I haven't seen either.
Justice League Dark, I haven't seen.
Batman Hush, of course, we haven't seen yet. And then upcoming, Nick, they got some projects coming up that look pretty interesting. Wonder Woman Bloodlines, which I've seen a trailer for to look good. Superman Red Sun. Justice League Dark Apocalypse War. I don't know what that is. And Superman Man of Tomorrow. What the hell is that?
Isn't there another Batman one coming, too? I forget what.
Oh, so Superman Man of Tomorrow is going to be about the early years of Superman. So I guess maybe they'll do an adaptation of John Byrne's Man of Steel, but they probably would have called it that. And then Apocalypse War is, I think that's going to end up being their version of the Darkseid War from the comics. So.
Yeah, but why is a Justice League Dark movie, though? That's the weird thing there.
Because it's a sequel to the first one, so that's weird. I don't know. In any event, more movies coming. Some will probably be good, some probably not so much, but we'll be here to let you know. And now that we've both got DC Universe, we should be able to watch these a little bit more expediently than in the past. Theoretically, anyway. There's just not time enough. Anyway, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got the rundown and maybe some other stuff.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. all of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and HistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We hope you enjoyed our countdown, and we hope you enjoyed those commercial messages about all the other excellent content you can find right here at Place to Be Nation. But I'd like to tell you about something else right now. I'd like to tell you about something very similar to what you just heard. I'd like to tell you about Place to Be Nation's pop feed. You see, right here at Place to Be Nation, pop! You can hear such exhilarating content as the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Why, that's us. Right now, we would like you to go and listen to last week's episode. We're real proud of it. We're real happy with it. We interviewed WWE SmackDown referee Jason Ayers for a new series we're working on called Secret Origins. Jason was an awesome guest. I highly recommend the episode. Really cool dude, friend of the show now, and we hope to have him back in the future, Nick.
Absolutely. Good times were had by all.
Indeed. And over on DC4U, Russell and Todd dive into what's going on with DC Comics right now in the monthly current events. Plenty going on in the world of DC Comics. They also read off listener picks, including yours truly, of course, for the best Justice League Unlimited episodes in honor of the show's 15th anniversary. My favorite animated comic book show of all time, Justice League Unlimited. On the inaugural sports edition of Looking Forward, Looking Back, Andy is joined by the Cowboy, Roger Morissette, Scott Criscolo, and Peter Winston to look forward and preview the upcoming NFL season, go Dolphins, as well as look back and analyze the most recent seasons of the NBA and the NHL. The Year in Pop returns with Andy and Scott being joined by George Ribellino and J. Arsenio D'Amato to discuss the news, sports, and pop culture of 1977. They are staying alive, my friend. On a new Sunday Groove, David is joined by guest Andy Helene to discuss their personal Desert Island discs. This is a good episode, folks. And be sure to send David your Desert Island discs picks over at Sunday Groove on Twitter. On this episode of Marvel Age, our favorite Sarcastic Four take a concentrated look, very concentrated look, at roughly one-third of the most significant of Marvel's output throughout 1972. Do you remember 1972, Nick?
No.
Do you remember talking about 1972, though?
No, I was in a stupor.
Ah, fair enough. The greatest song of the 80s tournament continues.
No, in all seriousness, it covers a very eclectic year, 1972, as Marvel is starting to dip its toe back into the horror genre. So we've got some classic superhero type storytelling alongside stuff like Tomb of Dracula, Werewolf by Night, and then something like Shanna the She-Devil as well. So something of a unique year for Marvel in 72.
Sounds saucy. The greatest song of the 80s tournament continues. There will be 4 polls a day posted for round 3. You can get in on the action on Facebook by searching PTBN's Greatest Song of the 80s Tournament and liking the page. Be sure to weigh in, folks. There may not be much Alabama on this list, but by God, there's a lot of Michael Jackson. So be sure to join in.
Yeah, Michael Jackson, U2, Billy Joel. I mean, that's what you need.
And I'm voting for Prince, even against himself. So, as we had today, Let's Go Crazy up against When Doves Cry, which I went with Let's Go Crazy. Don't think it's going to win, but we'll see.
As you should have.
And
we shall see, indeed.
What goes on over at the PTBN wrestling feed there, Nick?
On the PTBN wrestling feed, on the Place to Be podcast, JT Scott and Peter Winston take a look at the last Saturday night's main event of 1989. Ben Zani welcomes Southern and Deathmatch legend Tank on the 20th episode of Row 1, Seat 1, And on episode 3 of Extreme Three-Way Dance, JT, D'Amato, and Jenny run down the entire month of ECW Hardcore TV following the night the line was crossed. On PlaceToBeNation.com, PTBN's tribute to 1994 rolls on with lots of great content. Every Wednesday on PlaceToBeNation.com, we've got the most interesting and unexpectedly funny stories on the World Wide Web in Glenn's Weekly Walk. Check out our social media pages and message board at www.bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE, PPV, and TV Match Ever project. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your list.
Well, this is truly the night the line was crossed for the hard-traveling fanboys, because we're about to delve into the fine line of comic book news and movie news. It's a segment known the world over, as far away as New Zealand, as The Rundown. Take a week off from doing the rundown, and the world collapses in the world of comics. So much information overload, really, for a comic book fan. Flying left and
right. Lots of stuff. I think the biggest thing that happened since last we had a rundown was the D23 convention from Disney, which featured a bevy of pop culture announcements, but predominantly we're talking about those affecting the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Indeed. And these were announcements such as Black Panther 2 is happening. I mean, shocker. I know. I'm as surprised as anybody else. But Black Panther 2 is...
not just happening.
Is happening. With not director just happening. Ryan Coogler. And is expected to hit May 6th, 2022. So we got a long-ass wait for about Black Panther 2. But I'm sure it'll be worth the wait because Black Panther 1 was awesome. Any thoughts on this, Nick?
Mm-hmm. Oh, excited. A little surprised they're waiting this long. I mean, at that point, it will have been, 5 years since... first Black Panther was, 2018 or 2017? I forget.
18, I think. No, 17.
18. No, 18. So make up your mind, Greg. So over 4 years in between the initial film and the sequel. So that's a little surprising, but other than that, exciting.
Indeed. Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends are sort of returning on Disney Junior. Marvel's...
yeah, this has always been a no-brainer to me why there isn't a Disney Junior property, or Marvel property, and now there will be one. So with young kids, I'm excited about this, and maybe it'll be okay.
Geared toward preschoolers and their families, the series is set to debut in 2021 and will be the first full-length Marvel series for the Disney Junior audience. Cool stuff, Nick. Good for the girls there to watch at the Duke household.
Maybe. By 2021, it may be...
they won't be preschoolers anymore.
May have lost the appeal.
That's true, yeah. They'll be in regular school. God forbid. What else is next? The Moon Knight, She-Hulk, Moon Knight Shyamalan, all that stuff that's happening. So we got a bunch of announcements for more Disney Plus series. I mean, as if Disney Plus needed anything more to hook us after that Mandalorian trailer. They just keep dropping Marvel content on our laps, right? Among them, we are getting Miss Marvel. We are getting She-Hulk.
Live action.
Yeah, all these are live action. Miss Marvel, we are getting She-Hulk, and we are getting Moon Knight. These announcements came at the D23 conference as well. Exciting stuff here. Which of these has you most excited, Nick?
Of those three, it's tough because under any other circumstance, it would be Moon Knight by a pretty sizable margin. But with Disney's stated intention to keep Disney Plus an all-ages platform, I wonder, can this Moon Knight show have the edge it's going to need? But like you said, that Mandalorian trailer certainly did not seem to lack for edge. We shall see. Probably Moon Knight.
It did lack for Christian, though. So, you know, we'll have to see how that plays out. I am going to go with Moon Knight as well, even though I literally know nothing about the character except what you guys have told me. Because I never read Moon Knight growing up, so I've never read an actual Moon Knight story in my life.
Schizophrenic superhero, that's all you need to know.
Sounds exciting and interesting. And I'm also excited in a different way for Ms. Marvel, because I think it's a chance to grab a younger audience with the live-action content. So that's pretty exciting, too.
Not just a younger audience, but also opening up to an audience of Muslim descent as well.
Exactly. Broadening your appeal. I like it. So all of that's really exciting. We also got an announcement that isn't loading for me right now. About Falcon and Winter Soldier.
Wyatt Russell has been cast. Yes, Wyatt Russell has been cast as John Walker, a.k.a. the U.S. agent for Disney Plus's The Falcon and Winter Soldier show.
Right. I hope he has that badass black Captain America costume he had in the comics, too. Let's hope. So that's...
Yes, as do I.
So that's cool, and hopefully will also lead us to some great U.S. agent jokes in the future. As we saw in some of the comics we've read recently. We also got a little bit more information about Disney Plus's What If. Yeah. We got information, yeah. One of those bits of information is that Marvel Zombies, Captain Britain, and more will be a part of the animated What If's first season on Disney Plus. The show's Captain Britain will be the aforementioned Peggy Carter, which wasn't really aforementioned by us, I just said it in the article, voiced by Haley Atwell. Kevin Feige says almost every member of the MCU will be on this show. Time is more than a linear path. So that's pretty freaking awesome, Nick. What are your thoughts on all these announcements?
Oh, this is thrilling. What If is one of the projects for Disney Plus I'm most excited about. Getting to some of the voice cast back and getting to look at, you know, just some concepts that maybe would have happened had the MCU events gone a little differently. They also confirmed that the first season is going to be 23 episodes, one for each film in the Infinity Saga.
Other characters confirmed to be involved are Star-Lord, Bucky Barnes, and two versions of Steve Rogers, a zombie Captain America and Iron Steve Rogers.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Is that anything like Iron Mike Tenay?
No, I think it's Howard Stark building Steve Rogers an Iron Man suit.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, friend of the show, Ben Morse, will undoubtedly be happy because confirmation has come through that Kit Harington has been confirmed as Black Knight in Eternals.
All right, now here, let's go ahead. Can you settle this for us, Greg? Is it Eternals or Eternals?
I don't know. I just don't know, Nick. And what's more, I don't particularly care. I'll find out when the movie comes out, like everybody else. And I'll see how they refer it. Unless they don't actually call themselves the Eternals. What if that happens? Then we're all fucked. Pardon my language, folks.
We'll have to wait and see what Kevin Feige says. You know, when he says in an interview,
maybe,
then that would...
Maybe he doesn't even refer to them by name in the interview. Maybe he says, that project we have coming up. You know, and you have to... It's like one of those It's Pat things, where the mystery is better than actually revealing it. How do you say
It's Eternals? Pat.
How do you say it, Nick?
I tend to lead towards Eternals.
Normally I say Eternals. The Eternals. However, the Eternals could also work. But the Eternals doesn't work, right?
I don't know. Right. Anyway, the point is, Kit Harington is playing Dane Whitman, a.k.a. the Black Knight. So Kit Harington leaves one role where he played a guy who carried a sword and dressed in black to... fill another role where he's going to play a guy who carries a sword.
Explain to me his entire character arc from Game of Thrones. Summarize all 8 seasons.
No, I will not do that.
Well, that's not a nice thing to do to your good friend Greg Phillips.
Just ask in our group chat, and you could just ask in our Place to Be Nation Comics group chat, and you can probably get the whole thing spoiled for you if you want.
Summarized. It's just unlikely I'll ever block out time to watch all 8 seasons. It's just unlikely. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's unlikely.
I think it's one of those things that once you started, you would see it to fruition.
Perhaps so.
If nothing else, it would give you inspiration.
Fair enough. But that's not all the news. We also got news out of DC, believe it or not. Because DC is starting to really get going on James Gunn's The Suicide Squad. Let's delve into some of these announcements, shall we, Nick? Yes, we shall, is the answer to that.
Yes.
Number one, Nathan Fillion. Stop us if you've heard this before.
Oh, God.
Nathan Fillion.
The internet has ended. We have nowhere left to go in geek culture, Greg. We have reached the end of the road. We might as well stop here. Our one goal that we as nerds collectively held for the entirety of our existence has finally come to fruition. What more do we have to live for, Greg?
Not much, because finally Nathan Fillion has gotten a live-action role in a prominent comic book film. He has joined the Suicide Squad. We are not sure what character he is playing, at least according to what I'm reading here. A lot of these characters are being kept under wraps right now, which just leads me to believe this movie is going to be super fun. And it's not just Nathan Fillion. We also got an actual named character here, King Shark. Because King Shark's voice will be portrayed by comedian Steve Aggie. I don't actually know who this guy is, but King Shark's a hell of a character, and actually probably won't end up lasting very long in the movie, if I had to guess. But then again, you never know with James Gunn. Sometimes he takes the characters that are a little under the radar, so we'll have to see what he does with King Shark. Okay, who else do we have? Taika Waititi, your favorite, Nick. He is in talks to join the Suicide Squad as an actor. Of course, for DC fans, he's most well known for playing Pie Face in the Green Lantern film. Tom Kalmaku.
I don't think they ever actually called him.
No, they didn't, because it's horribly offensive. So he played Tom Kalmaku.
We'll talk about this off air.
All right. Yes, let's talk about it off air. Mr. Silver Age Green Lantern over here. Oh yes, and one last bit of news here that I overlooked. Peter Capaldi, who was in Doctor Who, of course, as the Doctor.
One of the Doctors.
Yes. He is confirmed.
Are you okay over there?
No, I'm trying to keep up with these
You sound like Dominic Mysterio trying to recite his promo right now.
Father, please, don't do this. We're in talks to...
Peter Capaldi is going to be in the Suicide Squad. Yes. He was on Doctor Who, where he played a doctor of some sort.
Yes, and you don't know who he's going to play in the Suicide Squad, appropriately enough. Also, annoying SNL... alumnus Pete Davidson is rumored to make an appearance in the movie. Hopefully he will get killed quickly.
Cameo, yes.
Finally, wrapping things up. No, not finally at all, in fact. Another big announcement, which this one, Nick, we got to talk about, because I'm reading some things in here that disturb me a little bit. One of our favorite characters, and a character that has grown attached to that character as well. Brandon Routh and Courtney Ford play Ray Palmer and Nora Dark on Legends of Tomorrow are being written out of the show and will no longer be full-time cast members on Legends of Tomorrow. Now, here's what's concerning to me about this. In the quote that Brandon Routh put out about this, he says, "Unfortunately, His storyline, Ray's, is pointed in another direction. I'm saddened to see Ray's journey end for now, but wish my Legends family well." Here's what... And Ford further said... Courtney Ford later said, if it would load for me, that would be wonderful. "If it were my choice, I'd play her for years to
come." Nora Dark is very close to my heart. Yeah, there we go.
If it were my choice, I'd play her for years to come. But I understand that stories run their course, and I'm grateful for the time I did. So the way that they're making it sound is that this was a decision from the writers, not a decision from the actors, to move on to other projects.
Yeah, that is.
And that frustrates me, Nick.
Like that.
That frustrates me, because we're losing Ray and Nora, but we're keeping freaking Wolfie and what's his name? What's the guy's name?
Mona.
Mona, Wolfie, and Gary, yes. We're keeping Mona and Gary, and we're losing Ray and Nora. What's up with that, Nick?
I don't know. I don't write the show.
Why don't you?
No, they won't let me.
Well, I don't like it.
Because they're afraid it would be nothing but...
Well, nothing.
Because I would bring on Dr. Kevin Nash to solve all their problems, and the show would just be that at that point. So they will not let me write this film, or this television show, I should say.
Fair enough. I just hope that it wasn't just a story thing, because Ray in particular feels like he is irreplaceable on the Legends. But we'll see. I've been wrong in the past about the show. They've always managed to keep me hooked. But I am concerned losing Ray.
And there's always the opportunity they could come back. I mean,
yeah.
They say here that they plan on checking back in on him at some point, and you never know. You get new writers. I mean, this show has changed writers and showrunners throughout its history. You get new writers in there, they may want Ray back. So, I mean, it's just, I'm trying not to overreact too much to this one.
True. Speaking of overreacting, let's talk about Watchmen some more. HBO's Watchmen debut has been set, and it will be competing with The Walking Dead and Supergirl. Watchmen will air Sundays at 9 o'clock Eastern, beginning October 20th. Are you ready, Nick? Are you ready for the Sunday Night Wars?
Let's dial the clock back 5 years. Let's go back to 2014. If you had told me that in 5 years' time, there was going to be a Walking Dead show, a Watchmen show, and a Supergirl show all airing at the same time, and the Supergirl show was going to be by far more interesting to me than the other two, I would have called you a liar. And yet, here we are.
You're a liar. No, it's pretty crazy. I'm not gonna lie though. I'm excited about the Watchmen premiere, or not the Watchmen premiere, the Walking Dead premiere, because last season was really good, even though you'll never watch it. But Watchmen, yeah. Good luck. Good luck joining my rotation at this point, Nick. With all the content, I'm starting to fully process the amount of content we're going to have in October alone. AEW, Raw, SmackDown, NXT, Arrow, The Flash, Legends, Supergirl, Batwoman, Black Lightning, I'll have Walking Dead, Titans. I'm sorry, Watchmen. And I never would have believed that Watchmen would come in last place there, Nick. Never, because Watchmen is the best comic book I've ever read. Still. But I just can't bring myself to care right now. Is that bad?
Nope. No, it's not. They just haven't done a good job of marketing the show to this point.
Nonetheless, we will see. Well, that's the rundown, which means it's time to get to reading and watching. What you been reading and watching, Nick?
Nothing.
What about playing?
No.
All right. Well, I got something for you, Nick. You ready? I've not been reading anything.
Yeah, I'm ready.
I've not been reading anything outside of long book preparation. But what I have been doing, what I have been doing is watching a little bit. I have now completed Supergirl's most recent season. I finished it, Nick.
And?
Have you finished it as well?
Yes, and? No, I have not.
Oh, well, I don't want to say too much here. I don't want to say too much. I don't want to spoil it, but I will say I liked it. I liked it. I did not quite adore it the way that a lot of people seem to have and said that this was by far their favorite season of Supergirl. I wouldn't go that far, but I liked it a lot. In particular, I loved Lex Luthor by the end of this run. Really good take on Lex. And really good job of kind of, at times, the show skirts around Supergirl being a likable person, because sometimes they have her, they write her so whiny at times and so constantly complaining about things that it's sometimes you forget that at her heart she's one of the most pure and likable people in the CW Arrowverse. And this season did a good job of bringing that back around, in particular near the end. And also the Red Daughter character ended up being great. Melissa Benoist did a wonderful job portraying these two wildly different and yet ultimately similar characters. So I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed the Lex stuff. Really enjoyed a lot, actually. And I thought the last episode was actually very, very good. I will say it was one of their best season finales that they've done to this point on the show. Maybe the best. I'd have to go back and watch the other ones. But there were still some inconsistencies on this season, some things that I didn't enjoy. I still don't like the forced romance of James Olsen's sister. I can't remember what her name is. Kelly, I think, with Alex. Doesn't work the way that the Maggie one did. And it felt really weird and shoehorned in and out of left field. Wasn't crazy about the James Olsen subplot. But ultimately, I liked what they did with Agent Liberty. So ultimately, a really good season of Supergirl overall, and I thought they closed it on a great note with a really nice finale. I would say if I were ranking the seasons from this past year, I would probably put Supergirl behind Arrow and behind Legends and ahead of Flash. So
good to hear. I'm looking forward. I need to hurry up and finish those before our stories come back, but we shall see if that's actually going to happen or not, because I still have to finish Black Lightning too.
Oh, yes, me too. I got to catch back up on that. I'm pretty far behind. And then I also watched an episode of Doom Patrol, episode 4, I think, of Doom Patrol. And actually, I might have watched two of Doom. No, I think just one. No, two. Yeah, I watched two episodes of Doom Patrol. And the episode number 4 was probably the worst episode yet, actually. Most of the episodes I've loved, but this was the first one that was actually kind of dull to me. Both David and I watched it. We agreed the first three were wildly entertaining, and this one was kind of... They introduced a John Constantine stand-in character, seemingly. Maybe it's a character from the comics that I just didn't recognize, but I did not enjoy it. Thought it was a weird... For a show that is so weird and so wild and zany, I thought this was way more toned down than the first three episodes had been. So hopefully they'll get through this little mini story arc and get back on track moving forward. You got to catch Doom Patrol at some point, Nick. It's a fun show.
Yeah, I got lots of stuff I need to catch up on. So the odds of Doom Patrol somehow finding its way to the top of that list, I would wager, is pretty slim.
Oh, it's great, though. Overall, it's been great. This episode was not, unfortunately, but every show has bad episodes.
Yeah, I just still have, I have to finish Young Justice. I have to finish the CW stuff, Crisis. I have to watch Krypton at some point. Yes. I have to watch Swamp Thing. It's not from a lack of interest. It's just I'm being honest. Like, the odds of me finding time to watch Doom Patrol anytime soon are I'm going to say slim to none. I haven't watched season 2 of Punisher. I haven't watched season 3 of Jessica Jones. You know how I feel about that show and that character in particular. So
you haven't watched
Doom Patrol.
You haven't watched all the seasons of Thunder in Paradise.
Not that you know of.
Well, I mean, I don't know what you're doing on your trips to Nashville randomly. I mean, I don't know what you do in there. You might fit some viewings of Thunder in Paradise.
Drinking.
You're just imagining that you're on the set of Thunder in Paradise in 1994.
Yes. In that harem episode.
Ooh, the harem episode. That was good stuff. That was good stuff. I just watched a clip the other day of Jim the Anvil Neidhart coming onto the set of Thunder in Paradise and knocking out Hulk Hogan from behind, and the crowd of people, I'm sorry, Hulk Hogan's character, and the crowd of people.
Bro, I would say, brother, that was not Hulk Hogan. That was Spencer.
Spencer.
Come on now.
And all the people say, hey, you can't do that. That's cheating. And Anvil runs off giggling. I'm assuming it wasn't the end. No, that would be great, is if he was actually playing Jim the Anvil Neidhart on the show, attacking this random boat captain, or whatever the hell he was. What was Spencer anyway? A boat captain? A submarine captain? What was his deal?
Hurricane Spencer, I'll have you know, Greg, is a former Navy SEAL who had started work as a mercenary, and he used his high-tech boat to help him go on adventure.
Hurricane Spencer. Hurricane Spencer.
What? Then you had Brubaker, his partner, and then you had Carol Alt.
Carol Alt. Oh, man, now I'm going to have to watch the paparazzi series tonight, aren't I, after the show.
Well, Carol Alt was the love interest, as you know.
She looks a lot like a young Carol Alt. There you go. Lord. So Brubaker was like his, that was his name, right? The partner?
Brubaker, yeah,
partner. That was his,
Chris Lemon.
That was his brother Brudeye. Everybody knew that when they watched the show. He was sort of the stand-in for Brother Bruda.
It was Jack Lemmon's kid.
Ah.
True story, Jack Lemmon's kid. Chris Lemmon.
Oh, I thought his name would have been Chris Lime. But I'll be here all week, folks. You can catch my act at the Comedy Store and charge free admission.
The sad thing is there were only 22 episodes of that wonderful show. It's just
really? Because I felt like it was promoted in WCW for like 3 years. Thunder in Paradise. Maybe it's just my child brain was processing life slower at that time.
It ran for 1 year, 22 episodes that started in March of 94, and the finale aired in November of 94.
Wow, that's wild. I would swear that I remembered them doing promotion for it in 95, but maybe I'm confusing it with Hogan's cameos on Baywatch.
They could have been doing reruns and stuff.
Or
you know,
TV
I don't know.
Movies. Or maybe I'm just confusing it with the Baywatch promotion they did when Hogan did his guest shots on Baywatch, you know?
Good Lord, Greg. There was a CDI, a Philips CDI interactive game.
I mean, we have to play this, don't we, for the show? We can count that as reasonable.
For one, we got to find a Philips CDI. And then, two, we got to find a copy of this game for Philips CDI.
How hard could it be?
I pretty hard, I'm imagining.
Oh, yeah. And as you know, if things are difficult, we're not a big fan of them. We here at the HTF.
We don't want to work on this show. We just want to come on here and dick around for an hour and a half.
Which we've successfully done.
Let's
move on to the next thing that we do every week, which is, of course, as everyone knows... I'm looking at the abacus on the floor, and it indicates to me that the positions are aligned as such that it's time for the wrestling minute. So
are you saying when the earth rotates on a 25 degree axis?
That's exactly what I'm saying, but there's only a 33 1/3% chance that anyone's still listening to the show at this point. So wrestling minute. There was a lot of wrestling that took place over the weekend, wasn't there, Nick? Sure.
Yes. Yeah, I haven't had a chance to watch All Out yet. AEW's All Out, which was, I would argue, the premier event of the weekend, the most hyped event of the weekend. I did watch NXT TakeOver UK, which I thought was pretty good. I thought it was a big step up from their first NXT UK TakeOver they did. I don't even remember where the first one was. Blackpool, I believe. This one, of course, was in Cardiff. And Tyler Bate and Walter in the main event absolutely tore the house down. Had an outstanding triple threat tag match for the NXT UK tag title.
I actually haven't watched the Walter and Tyler Bate match yet, but that tag team match was sensational.
Yeah, and then you had a really good, or what I thought was pretty good, women's match between Toni Storm and Kaylee Ray. And then you had other things on there as well. Cesaro and Ilya Dragunov, yeah. I believe is the guy's name.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the guy wrestle before, but Cesaro, as he often does, delivered. Noam Dar taking on, I don't even remember who he wrestled in the first match. But that wasn't bad.
Yeah.
And then you had Joe Coffey, one of the Coffees, and against Dave Mastiff in a last man standing match that, while not great, at least things were happening, unlike a lot of last man standing matches.
Right.
So all things considered, enjoyed it. Looking forward to catching up on All Out at some point as well.
Let it be known, folks, this is the rare time you'll ever hear us give a compliment to Noam Dar, the no-good Noam Dar, who we've held a grudge against since he eliminated Ho-Ho Loon.
Bastard.
From the Cruiserweight Classic.
One day.
But he did have a
one day.
He did have a solid showing here.
Oh, now wouldn't that be something, Greg, if Ho-Ho Loon were one of Chris Jericho's mystery partners on the first episode of AEW's television show.
Talk about turning the tide of the war, am I right? If they could get him involved. I'm talking about Ho-Ho. You won't even need a second partner at that point. Like, just one
one
Ho-Ho Loon would be enough to take out Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks. So, you know, Jericho wouldn't even have to do anything. He'd just stand on the apron the whole time. He could go to the Longhorn Steakhouse and enjoy all the steaks that he wants.
And get his title belt stolen.
And he wouldn't have to worry about it because Ho-Ho Loon would be there. No one was going to steal from him.
Ho-Ho Loon would be at the ring taking care of Kenny Omega and
that's
the Young
Bucks.
That's
a good point. Yeah, it's hard to do.
And Chris Jericho's title.
Even Ho-Ho Loon can't be in two places at once. That's a very interesting point. No, I thought the takeover card has been excellent so far. I'm looking forward to watching Bate and Walter once we get off the phone here. Once we get out of the studio here, and I've heard nothing but good things about it. I think you'll enjoy All Out. It was up and down. There was some stuff I didn't like, but there was a lot of stuff I loved. And the Young Bucks match in particular was a standout. Kenny and Pac was really good as a match. The main event, I thought, was really good and told a great story. And, you know, there was really good stuff up and down the card. Six-man tag was very good. The Japanese women's match was good, as you would expect. So I dug the card. I did not think it was as good as Double or Nothing. I thought it was more along the lines of something like Fyter Fest. But really good show regardless, and it's fun to see that variety show approach because not everything's going to be for everybody. But I thought every different type of wrestling audience got served by at least one of the matches, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Well, that's been the wrestling.
And speaking,
go ahead.
Greg, yeah, speaking of All Out, we could not talk about All Out without mentioning our good friend of the show, WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross, who, as you all know, has been providing us with our musical exits here for the last little while. But what a lot of people don't know about JR is that he's actually bilingual. JR is fluent in both English and Spanish. And so today, he's going to show off some of those skills.
Oh, wow.
A little song from back in the 80s. From a little country singer by the name of Freddie Fender. Jim, do you remember old Freddie Fender there?
JR's got to make his way into the studio, folks. Hang on. He's walking around the studio now. He's nodding his head.
You know, Cowboy actually used to do business with Freddie Fender. Not a lot of people know that. Freddie Fender had hair that was magnificent. One of the best looks. Like, you're just looking at this guy on the street, and you say, that guy's a star. That son of a bitch is a star. Now, Freddie Fender came in and worked the territory. He was there for quite a while. He did some stuff with Terry Taylor. He did some stuff with One Man Gang. But at the end of the day, what made Freddie different from the other wrestlers of that era was that, A, he wasn't a wrestler. B, he was not trained in any way to be a wrestler. And C, he was actually a hell of a singer. So we gave him a guitar and we said, Freddie, just get out there, be yourself. If you're not a wrestler, if you don't want to be a wrestler in the ring, that's fine. But you've got a career if you just believe in yourself. And that's when he came out with this little song. If he brings you happiness, Then I wish you all the best. It's your happiness that matters most of all. But if he ever breaks your damn heart, if the teardrops ever start, well, quite frankly, I will be there before the next teardrop falls. And folks, it's always been broken down to me like this. Si te quiere de verdad, y te da felicidad, te deseo lo más bueno, palos dos, pero si te hace llorar. A mí me puedes hablar y estaré contigo cuando triste estás. In other words, I will be there anytime you need my ass by your side to drive away every teardrop that you cried. And if he ever leaves you blue the way that Leroy McGurk used to do, just remember I love you and I will be there before the next teardrop falls. That's right, folks. I will be there before the next teardrop falls.
Our traveling fanboys.